Welcome to Rock That Relationship, a podcast about all things relationship with Corey and Tracy.
Now let's get real and start creating relationships that rock.
Welcome everyone to Rock That Relationship. We are here in season six talking all about relationships, and what a great topic, obviously, because we're a Rock That Relationship. But today we are going to be talking with an intimacy expert, Julie Hall, who is a licensed marriage and family therapist, who is going to shed some insight on intimacy in relationships. What is it? Building it, fostering it, and what to do if it maybe disappears. So I'm going to turn it over to Julie. Welcome so much, and thank you for being on the show.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Well,
thank
excellent.
You.
Well, Julie, maybe you could start by just sharing with us, you know, like what actually is intimacy? Like, can you define it? And then how is it important in a long-term relationship, or why is it important in a long-term relationship?
Yeah. Well, thanks both of you for having me, and I'm happy to be here. It's a great question, and there are, you know, I think a lot of different definitions out there as far as intimacy. I think, you know, if you take it down to sort of brass tacks, it's closeness, right? It's just mm-hmm. the closeness between, you know, a group, whether it's a dyad, two people, three people. It's just how connected you feel. You know, one of the things that I often say in my work with couples is that you can have safety, right, without intimacy, but you can't really have intimacy without safety, right? Meaning that you can feel safe with somebody, right? Like, it, you know, be in space with someone and the alarm bells don't go off, you feel comfortable, right? But that doesn't mean that you feel intimacy with them. That doesn't mean you necessarily feel connection, doesn't mean you necessarily feel closeness. And at the same time, you cannot experience closeness, intimacy, connection without that safety, right? Without just that baseline of safety. So I just think that's important, because oftentimes couples come to me and, you know, one partner's frustrated that, you know, the other partner isn't connected to them. And at the same time, they're missing a lot of safety components. So we'll probably get there. But I think, again, at the highest level, it's really just, you know, how close you feel to someone, how connected you feel.
And that's not just sexual, right? I mean, we're talking about like actual feelings and being able to talk to the other person and be vulnerable with that person.
That's exactly right. That's exactly right. It's certainly not just, you know, like a physical sexual connection. It's the emotional connection. Mm-hmm. In so many ways, that is even more powerful. It's what lends itself into emotional, physical closeness.
And this is a big question, but like afraid of intimacy. So there's a lot of people who are afraid of intimacy. And why do you think that is? Is that past hurts from their parents, things like that? Or do we as people just not trust each other, or we just go out and hurt each other and then we become, you know, guarded after each hurtful experience?
I mean, I think it's all of the things that you're putting language to, right? It's so much of it, I think, comes from our history, right? What the world around us has communicated to us, whether it be intimate, you know, past relationships, whether it be just what we've seen in the world. I always describe it as how we've been responded to or not responded to, right? Impacts how we then show up, right? It's like, you know, we have our five senses, right? But then we have our sixth sense, and our sixth sense is often like our meaning making sense. How we actually make meaning, right, of the world around us, right? And so often the fear of intimacy can come from how we've been responded to or not responded to, right? If I, you know, offer myself up at some point, right, you know, share something, and the message I get is it's not important, right? Or defensiveness, right? Or, you know, it's shifted to then that person, right? Then the story that I tell myself is it's not going to be effective for me to drop down into vulnerability, right, into more intimate places. It's not going to be effective. It's going to be, to some extent, dangerous.
Well, it's interesting. Oh, sorry.
I was just going to follow up on that real quick because, you know, when we talk about people who say, well, I've got a lot of walls up, right? I mean, that's like the common cliche for that. I've got a lot of walls. And someone's like, well, we need you to break down those walls so we can get closer. And, you know, it's, we have semantics, we have words around it, but you know, you got to do more than just saying, oh, I'm going to break down those walls. Like what is, especially if that person maybe even subconsciously doesn't feel safe, but doesn't even realize that that's what's going on. So what do you do with someone who even recognizes that they need to break down their walls or they want to break down their walls? Where do they start?
Well, and just so I'm tracking with you, do you mean like as a therapist, how do I engage that? Or like, what do I recommend for couples who are in that space?
Yeah, mostly like what might a couple do, maybe even on their own, or a person do on their own, knowing that they're sort of navigating the world with these walls up, and they know that they tend to not get close to people, whether they either consciously or subconsciously have, you know, recognized these unsafe or perceived unsafe conditions. Where does a person start? Because sometimes, you know, like a lot of times we tell ourselves like, oh, I need to do, I should do, but like, you know, these walls have been built for reasons. And so, you know, what might you say to, you know, not even just a therapist as a therapist, but what might you just suggest for couples that, or an individual in looking at this kind of thing?
Therapy. Yeah. Focus therapy.
Yes. Tracy's a therapy, you know.
I love therapy. Yes.
Yes. You know, and I think I would say you're spot on. And obviously, you know, there, people have their own blocks for, you know, or lack of access or whatever that looks like. And, I would say 1,000%. I think if you can, you know, find a therapist where, you know, it's a safe space, that's really, I think, critical, because the way maybe that I would love to answer this is through something that I call my 3 C's. And it's this sort of sequential thing. And the 3 C's are curiosity, then compassion, and then courage. So what I would say is that process really starts with curiosity, right? And I think to your point, Tracy, that's where the therapeutic component can be really, really helpful, because you have a professional there with you who is really probing you, asking pointed questions, maybe about your history, right? You know, the stories that you have told yourself about yourself or about the world around you based on what you've been through, right? Or based on what's been modeled to you, right? Really engaging, your own story, right? And certain people can, you know, do that themselves, right? Maybe through books or through their own, you know, introspection. But the curiosity, I think, is really critical as far as just asking yourself questions about, what are my blocks, right? What are some of the things that I've been, what are some of the patterns that I've noticed in my own, you know, family history, right? What are some of the narratives, right, from my history? What are some of the things that I've been through, right? You know, trauma, right? And then from that place, right, when you start asking those questions, what we want to then practice is compassion for the responses to those questions. I would say the practice of self-compassion is a table stakes in my work with clients. You know, and self-compassion, often people think about it as like, well, I'm just giving myself a pass, or, you know, I'm just, you know, giving myself permission to sort of like dwell in something, or, and in fact, the practice of self-compassion, there's a lot of research out there, particularly coming from UC Berkeley, that tells us that the practice of self-compassion opens up the centers of our brain that tell us we are capable of growth and change, right? So in fact, the practice of self-compassion actually accelerates our growth if we're engaging it properly, right? And I would say self-compassion is looking at our story, not from a place of what's wrong with me, but from a place of what happened to me, what happened to me, right? That has maybe caused me to move in this way, caused me to have these blocks. And maybe these blocks to some extent are adaptive, right? They've been protective for me for my good reasons, right? And then once I can engage my story with self-compassion, with some more understanding, then I have opportunity to make some change. That's the courage component, like to step into some new moves mindfully, thoughtfully, with, you know, awareness of risk. So that's, I think, where I would start. It's from that place of curiosity and then the practice of compassion to then shifting. But we shift gently, right? I would never tell someone to go from 0 to 100, right? We shift with a gentleness. Yeah.
Well, okay. So I have 3 questions, but I'll go with the first one.
Okay.
You said gently, you wouldn't ask someone to go from 0 to 100, right? So I'm more of 0 to 100. And I think a lot of people are. So they start therapy and they're like, I'm not moving fast enough, or I'm not changing fast enough, or this therapist just wants to make money, when there's really a therapeutic, right? They feel that the process is drawn out for some other purpose. And I think, you know, they go, I've talked to several people who have started therapy and they don't, they're mistrustful from the beginning about the therapeutic process. And it's like you just said, why can't you take those people from 0 to 100 right away? What would happen? Especially if we're talking some serious trauma background.
Totally. I think there's danger in going from 0 to 100 in that what happens is maybe there's short-term change, but it's not sustainable. Right. And it's not sustainable because we're not engaging it with a mindfulness of risk. Right. So if I go from 0 to 100, right, and, I'm not met, right, with, you know, what I'm hoping for, right, with regard to that change, what could happen is that then I double down on my walls again. Mm. Right. Like I go back to my old moves, yeah, and I double down on those old moves. Right. So I would say, you know, and you navigate this, you know, individually with each client. Right. But I would say the healthiest way to approach shift is through a mindfulness of risk. Right. That doesn't necessarily mean 0 to 5. It could mean 0 to 30. Right. But we have to look at like, what are those guardrails for you? Right. What are those guardrails when you're engaging a new practice that reminds you, you can move through it with some, you know, understanding of sustainability.
That's great. And okay, I'll come back to it. But I have this other question is, there are these people who have walls up. There are people who, you know, have, they're like, I know I have walls or I have blocks, and yet they still seek out relationships, right? So they have this fear of intimacy and yet they want to be in a relationship. I was one of those people. It took me a long, long time to work through that. But I also have dated those kind of people. And I try to go 0 to 100, like, let's get this solved so that we can move on. Right. And I think what happens then is like a backlash almost. Or, you know, I dated someone who was like, well, if I start therapy, then I'm going to be in the fetal position and I'm not going to be able to even recover, right? So it's this fear of like even opening up. But then when you do open up, that these memories or whatever is going to engulf you. And then do people have a backlash to them? Then they, like you said, they put up more walls. I mean, they're clearly drawn to be in relationship, right? But then they get in them and this is causing, I think, so many people's problems, right?
Yes, I think that's exactly right. I think we all have this longing, like we all have this longing for, you know, relationship. Like it's almost like we are built that way. Like we're built for connection, right? And also I would say we heal in relationship, right? Healing happens through positive relational experience. I would say one of the most powerful experiences in the therapeutic space is, non-judgment is what it means to be received with non-judgment, right? When someone can hold space for you, right? Without criticism, right? Without trying to fix it right away, but just holding that space for you. It's really powerful. It's a healing experience, right? So, you know, I think it's tough. Like, and I would never find fault in someone who tries to engage relationship, right? Even though they're not necessarily in that place of like full healing. Frankly, none of us are, right? I would say we're all on some journey, right? Of, you know, and it's a continual process, right? I always describe it as unlearning and learning, unlearning and learning, right? So yeah, it's tough. It's not easy. Relationships are hard, and they can also be incredibly beautiful.
I love your answers for these, because you're talking about creating this like space, this that you know, as the person. So in a relationship, you think about, maybe I'm the person who's coming in and I don't have any recognizable intimacy issues, or at least anything that I'm thinking about on the forefront. And maybe I'm partnered with someone who is, and thinking about that responsibility that I have to be sort of extra aware of the space that I'm creating. Because, I mean, while we should be obviously non-judgmental for everyone, but you know, the stakes are a little higher when you know that this person might be trusting you, and you're the first person they've trusted their whole lives, and you kind of want to make sure you don't mess that up for them. I mean, do you ever have those situations where that equilibrium is off in like a couple dynamic, and you're like, the responsibility of that person who's sort of trying to create and foster that space 24/7, like what that might do to that relationship?
I do. I mean, I think it's all about, like, you know, a relationship isn't necessarily about this person or that person. It's about the space in between us, like what's happening in the space in between us, right? And I'm trained, my modality is emotion-focused therapy. You heard of it?
Mm-mm.
If I could just share about it at like the highest level, like emotion-focused therapy is a modality of therapy where first, what we're trying to understand, both of us in the relationship, we're trying to understand our triggers. The things that happen outside of us that's sending a message from our brain to our nervous system that's telling us we're under some kind of threat. Could be anything. Could be a tone. Could be something that's said. Could be a behavior, right?
A facial expression. Facial expressions trigger me.
Okay.
Blank face.
Yeah. Yes. It could be a facial expression. Mm-hmm. Right. And that trigger, right? Like I said, it sends this message to our bodies that we're under some kind of threat. I generally say it's a threat to either our feelings of safety, our feelings of love, and our feelings of belonging. Anytime we experience, and again, it could be real threat or perception of threat. Oftentimes it's perception of threat. Mm-hmm. And where we are in our lives right now, it's often a perception of threat. But the body does not distinguish between perception of threat and real threat. Sometimes it feels like that, like facial expression, the way that you describe that, Tracy, it's as if I saw a bear like on a hike, like mm-hmm. my body reacts right. in the same way. And that's threat response behavior, right? So we've all heard of fight or flight, right? Those are very common experiences of threat response behavior. There's also fawn, which is people pleasing, or freeze, which is I just kind of go blank, right? Or like numbing out behaviors. Any of those are threat response behaviors. And it's really important, I think, for us in the relational experience to understand, what are my triggers at the higher, like at a high level? What are my general threat response behaviors? And how do my threat response behaviors activate in my partner their threat response behaviors? Yeah. So for example, if I'm typically fight, like that's my threat response behavior, and fight could look like I get defensive, sarcastic, hostile, rage, retaliatory. What it can often activate in the partner is their own maybe flight.
Mm-hmm.
So like we call it, like one person is often the pursuer and then the other person is the withdrawer. Like the more you try to pursue me, the more I'm going to retreat. And the more you retreat, the more I'm going to double down on my pursuit. But the more I double down on my pursuit, the more the other person wants to retreat, right? And so mm-hmm. on and on we can go in these cycles, right? We call it like negative interaction cycles, right? So I think it's really important that we have and build awareness around, what are my triggers? What are my threat response behaviors? And what is the underlying threat that I so often can feel? Like so often, go ahead, you're going to ask a question.
Well, I was just going to say that this is not a nice or therapeutic way to say it, but it's what people always just say. Well, you just have to meet someone who's crazy matches your crazy, right? So that's a rude way to say it. But what they're saying really in essence is, are your triggers, are you able to handle each other's triggers, right? And if rather than saying that in that rude way, like an understanding that you don't have to match someone else's triggers. You can work towards a better way. Like you both can have your triggers. You can come into the relationship with your triggers, and then you can work together to try and figure out a different response when those come up. Right. So
absolutely.
I think a lot of relationships wouldn't fail if people understood that. basic
100%. And one thing I always say is it just takes one person to elevate. If mm-hmm. one person in the system, when you're in the throes of a negative interaction cycle, can sort of step out and say, whoa, what's happening here? Right? Or recognize that you are in fact in a cycle, right? That it's in fact not you versus me. It's us versus the cycle that we get into, right? That really lends itself to opportunity to shift the whole dynamic, right? But what we, I think, try to do in emotion-focused therapy is drop people down to more vulnerable conversations. So rather than when we're in conflict, we're talking to each other from like our threat responses, what's actually happening underneath that kind of line of awareness, right? Like, what is it that, what is the actual threat that's coming up for me, right? Like I describe it, if I could, I describe it like if when I experience a trigger, any kind of trigger, it's as if like someone put a t-shirt on me, okay? And the t-shirt says something like this, I am blank. Like, and the I am statement sounds like I am unlovable. I am unworthy of love. I am rejected. I am not good enough. I am a failure. I am alone, right? These are not pretty stories. And they're often not stories that were birthed out of that relationship. They're stories that have been with us that get activated when we experience a trigger, right? And so what we want to try to practice is looking at what is in fact that more vulnerable story that's happening in that experience, right? When we're doing that, what often happens is it shifts the conversation into actual connection, right? It shifts the conversation into a kind of new experience. There's nothing more powerful than knowing that someone can hold a vulnerable story that I have, right? A vulnerable experience that I have.
Mm-hmm. I like that so much because I think about the difference between maybe you have this partner who you trust and you tell them something that there's a trigger and you're at least aware that it's a trigger and you come to them and you say, this is a trigger, and they dismiss it with the, that shouldn't be a trigger. I'm not that person that did that to you. And then all of a sudden what could have been a really amazing opportunity for a safe space to be created just all of a sudden closed in. And now right. It's like that remove that vulnerability instead of having that partner say, you know, I don't understand what it means to be triggered by this because this isn't my trigger, but I'm here for you. And I want to listen, or I, you know, just what is it you need from me in this time? And I think about all the missed opportunities that couples have when they could go to that vulnerable space of support and they instead kind of shoot them out of the trigger. It's, you know,
well, they attack each other. They're triggered by each other's triggers, right? Like, again, we've talked about this before. I think this stuff should be taught starting in middle school or grade school. Like, people aren't getting this at home. A lot of people. I was married for 8 years to a psychotherapist and yet still could not understand any of this. And I was triggered by everything. And what you just said about like the t-shirt saying, I am this, like everything that came at me in the form of, hey, I want to make this relationship better. Or I want to talk about this, turned into me feeling like I was being attacked, and then I had to go on the attack, and we just cycled. And I don't do that at all anymore. And I'm so different only because of the therapist that I had, you know, and the years of therapy. But like you say that, and I feel it like my whole body right now, it's like my eyes are going to pop out. Like I'm very tense. My chest is like, because I lived that way for decades, right? And did not understand it. Yes. And you're right. It's not the two people. It's the dynamic you're fighting.
It's the dynamic, right? And this is where I think, you know, we have like in relationship where there is opportunity is that practice of co-regulation, right? So if like one of my stories, one of the things that gets activated for me, right, is that I am not good enough, right? Or let's say, you know, my partner saying something to me and it activates in me this place that says I fail. right? And so what happens then for me is I start to kind of like withdraw. Like that's my threat response behavior. I withdraw. But the more that I withdraw, the more my partner wants to like go at me. But then I feel more and more criticized, right? Like that's the way that I interpret it. Like I'm being criticized. So I pull away even further, right? And then the more I pull away, the more maybe it activates in my partner's story that they're alone.
Mm-hmm.
So now there are these two really vulnerable stories that are happening in the cycle. One person feels really criticized and they're not good enough. And the other person's feeling alone, but we're not talking about any of those things.
Right.
Instead, we're just coming at each other, right? So that's where there's opportunity. If we can really tap into our own, you know, our own sort of cycles, whether it be our own pain cycles, right? Or, you know, their pain cycles, then we have opportunity to say, you know what? When this happens, I feel really alone. And the opportunity then that my partner has in that place is to be an agent of co-regulation, right? To say, well, how can I support you there? What does that look like? Right? Like, what does it look like to feel supported in that place?
So do you find that couples come to you after they've already had a ton of these cycles and they're just almost at a breaking point, or they are literally coming to you to because they're done? It's like therapy or we're done? Or do they come sooner?
It's a great question. I would say a lot of couples come like when they are like in pretty dire straits. Like they mm-hmm. are in a really like a real place of crisis.
Mm-hmm.
Some don't, you know, some couples, they just want to like improve their communication. They're noticing they're in some kind of transitional time and they're wanting to strengthen their relationship. But most in my experience have come when, like it's at a really, you know, really severe place.
Mm-hmm.
And that's tough, right? But it's, you know, I'll give you an example in my own relationship. I've been married for 17 years. And yeah. My partner and I have done this work. And I remember one distinct incident where my threat response behavior is fight and my partner's is flight. And so we were kind of in that dynamic and I was, like getting heated about something and he paused and he said, I know when your tone goes up like that, it's usually because you're scared about something.
Mm.
And that was, mm-hmm. for me, just like a record scratch moment. It's something about my partner noticing that disarmed me. And I had to pause. And I said, huh. And it just helped really shift the conversation because we had already done this work, right? As far as like, These are the things that activate me. This is my threat response behavior. Generally, this is the threat that I'm feeling when I show up in that kind of behavior. And he was able to tap into it. So that's why I would say it just takes one of us in the partner dynamic to elevate, right? For us to kind of shift. And that's intimacy. I think there's nothing more beautiful than feeling held in those spaces of vulnerability.
And for someone to recognize that, he recognized, right? He yeah. recognized in you, which made you seem, you felt seen and heard, right?
That's right. When someone can see me beyond what I'm exhibiting, right? What the behavior that I'm exhibiting, exactly. Someone can see underneath that or just even conjectures underneath that, right? Even if they didn't necessarily get it right, which I think he in fact did, but they're trying to see if there's something underneath that, getting curious.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I was going to say this. I mean, I wish that we all went through like relationship 101 before we got into relationships, because I think about like,
yeah.
You know, I mean, unfortunately, a lot of this is we kind of learn on the job. I mean, like, as, you know, doing this podcast is like, wow, look at all these tools that I could have had at my disposal before I wrecked a whole bunch of relationships, right? You know, you think about all of these amazing things that you can do. And, you know, and then it kind of shifting a little bit from this is, you know, couples that might have really good, strong, solid, healthy intimacy on whatever levels that they're seeking, who then over time lose that. So there might not be a conflict around the, like, the safety part of intimacy, but it just sort of becomes a form of disconnection, you know, where they say passing ships in the night kind of thing. Do you ever work with couples who are in those situations and helping them kind of revive the intimacy?
Absolutely. That's such a great, I think, point, right? Around, like, safety might be there, but they're missing connection, right? Yeah. They're missing that closeness, right? Because of, you know, all kinds of things. Yes, I do. And, you know, I think that's, it's difficult, right? It's often harder to see, because it's not so, like, glaring and jarringly problematic, right? And we just, you know, sometimes it's just we get busy. Mm-hmm. And so I think there's often even just a vulnerability in, recognizing it. Right. And recognizing, oh, something's off, right? Something's off between us, right? The connection is missing. Closeness isn't there, right? We haven't had sex, right? We haven't been, and that to even, you know, share that can be vulnerable, can be tough. But I think really important, I would say one of the keys in that place is communication. I know that sounds kind of basic. But I think often how intimacy gets chipped away at is we are not having conversations that are important to have. It's almost like the death by a thousand cuts, right? It's just kind of like over time, things just sort of build up, resentments build up. You know, yeah, I could say that, but, you know, why bother, right? And then it's just, you know, it just is a build up over time. And so I think, you know, what we want to, how do we tend to that is each partner acknowledging it, each partner acknowledging their side of the street, right? As far as their own kind of contributions to the lack of connection. Like, I would say the most important, for me, the most important characteristic as far as, like, healthy relationship, it's not love, respect, communication. For me as a therapist, and other therapists might say something different, it's humility. Right. It's my own humility as far as recognizing that I have some contribution to this, right? Like, I've missed, you know, moments with you, right? Like, I've missed opportunities to, you know, care for our relationship, right? And the more that I can offer that, the more that my partner wants to lean into, yeah, and I also have too, right? The more that I can express how I've engaged in lack of connection, the safer it makes the space for my partner to say, yeah, I've contributed to it too. And then we start to build, like, what does it look like to, you know, feel connected, right? In this season of your life, it could look different than maybe your relationship 10 years ago. Like, what does connection look like now, right? And again, just opening that up to curiosity. Let's talk about, like, where you can, you know, create space for that. Right? Connection for every person can feel different, right? Can look different.
Well, we always talk about this on the podcast, how different Corey and I are, right? We come from different perspectives. So she always addresses the, like, okay, what if people kind of drift apart? But I have a trauma history of my own. So complex PTSD, much more volatile stuff, right? And so when we're talking about you, I know you specialize with people with trauma history. So people with trauma histories, and attachment issues from those trauma histories, are they capable of changing that? Are they capable of working within a relationship, you know, to heal that stuff or to heal themselves so that they can be in a relationship? Because those things create a lot of volatility.
I would say yes, absolutely.
Do you need to heal yourself first? Like,
you know, I would say it can happen in relationship also, you know, I'd say absolutely, you know, it doesn't necessarily have to be sequential, right? It could be, I would say absolutely, like, do your own work, right? All of us do our own work. And trauma, like, you know, complex trauma, like, that's that's in, you know, in and of itself, I think that's important to look at as far as how to treat complex trauma, complex PTSD, all of that. That's very unique. And I think, important to work with a professional around. Absolutely. It could be in the space of relationship, but just again, offering that, you know, self-disclosure to your partner as far as like, this is what I'm working on, right? And you want a partner who, has the capacity to hold that, to move through that with you. And then there's trauma, and there's a definition of trauma that I have found to be sort of like more all encompassing, which is trauma is anything that happened to us that was either too much too fast, too much too long, or not enough too long, where we did not receive adequate support or resourcing. Anything that happened to us that was too much too fast, too much too long, or not enough too long, right? Where we just didn't receive the resourcing that we need. And a lot of us can identify, I think, with that definition, right? So I say that only because it's important for all of us, I think, to recognize where things like that have happened in our own lives. Could be one significant event. It could be, you know, something that wasn't necessarily as significant, but over time, the pattern of that same thing happening, right, causes this kind of impact on how I see myself and how I see the world around. So it behooves all of us, I think, to engage in the healing of our own traumatic experiences. Again, it can be, and I think, and again, other therapists might say something different. I think it can happen in the space of relationship as long as we are being really intentional about communication with our partners, right? And we are with partners where, who have that capacity and who, are agents of safety for us.
Mm-hmm. I totally agree. And I think, you know, there's a space for being in your own therapy and in couples therapy at the same time. Or, you know, I mean, that's been for me really beneficial. There's so much I didn't understand without doing individual therapy, you know?
Mm-hmm. And some things are, you know, I think just some things are, I think better served for us in individual therapy, right? To engage in the individual therapy space, right? Just to like really give ourselves permission to go in the deep dive and not have to utilize, you know, any of our energy to like notice, okay, how's my partner feeling about this thing I just said, right? Like this is just between me and, you know, the safe space that I'm building with my therapist. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well, I want to ask you a question because I know, you know, as Tracy mentioned, we are completely different in our experiences, our perspectives, just how we navigate the world, which is why people listen to this because they're like, oh my goodness. Every time they're like, they go down one road with Tracy, then they go down one road with me and they're like, whoa, you know, so many options. But we do, you know, we do agree on some of the, obviously the more fundamental things, you know, therapeutic approaches and, you know, kind of self-awareness. We're onto those pages, but we show up in life very differently. But I wanted to ask a question. Really kind of thinking about, you know, as we look at intimacy in general and kind of going back to this idea of intimacy potentially fading out or being distracted or being redirected, you know, we hear a lot of people say like, I've lost that intimacy with my partner. And instead of saying something or doing something about it, I let it like die a slow death, which I did in one of my relationships. I called it watering the garden, and then I didn't water the garden enough. And by the time I showed up and there were all the plants were dead, I was like, oh, wait a minute. And I just poured water all over them and it was too late. They, yeah. You know, and so I think about the things that can happen during the time in which you're not tending to your garden. And, you know, some people will shift intimacy and, you know, it may be shifting it around being in, you know, having infidelity and that kind of thing, but it could also just be simply shifting intimacy in general. You know, like feeling disconnected from your partner. So you tell your best friend or your coworker all the really important stuff. And then by the time you process through it, you don't even need to bring it up with your partner. And you create these kind of survival mechanisms that in essence, you feel like you're getting your garden watered, but you're sort of watering a different garden at that point in time. And so it doesn't always have to be cheating, but you know, do you have any thoughts on this kind of like this displaced intimacy that happens when we feel like we lack it with our intimate partners?
I think that is absolutely something that can happen. It happens more commonly than not, frankly, especially with access to social media. You know, I found like people connecting with high school sweethearts, right? Or, you know, like just sort of developing what we would describe therapeutically as competing attachments, right? Or they're finding connections with, you know, people at work. And so that is absolutely something that can happen. I mean, how do you tend to that? I would say the most important thing for us to really practice is intimacy with self. Like really developing an understanding of what's happening for me in these places, right? What am I thinking? What do I feel? Right? What am I feeling? What do I need? What do I think? What do I need? What do I feel? The more that I can develop an intimacy with myself, right? The more opportunity I have to share with my partner, hey, something's missing here, right? Hey, something's lacking here. Hey, we need to talk about this, right? The practice of intimacy with self is also like a groundedness, right? The more grounded I am in like my own experience or where I am, the safer that I feel to share it.
So you're saying like when you say intimacy with self, checking into yourself, why am I feeling this way? Why am I, you know, reacting this way? Like understanding yourself. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, basically. Yeah. Right. I'd say that's the most important relationship, right? Is our relationship with ourselves, right? What does it, you know, Brene Brown, you guys are, I'm sure, feeling, right? She always say like, she always says this, it's this practice of not betraying myself. Like, what does it look like for me to not betray myself? Right? The competing attachments that I build, I would say there's no, I mean, I hate to make big blanket statements, but I'm not seeing where it does not chip away at my most proximate intimate relationship. Right? It does. I've not seen a case where it doesn't chip away at my most proximate relationship. Right? And so then what does it mean for me to recognize that? Like what does, and put language to, what it looks like to water this garden, mm-hmm. right? This mm-hmm. relationship. But so often we move in the subconscious state. You get tracking. It's like, right. just kind of like going through the motions. And then I kind of like fall into these competing attachments. So that practice of intimacy and understanding self helps mitigate moving into competing attachments.
And being able to ask that person what they need, right? What does that mean to them, right? So, being able to articulate it for yourself, what does it mean that you're being intimate with me or that we are being intimate? And what does that mean to you, the other person, so that we can get on the same page, right?
Exactly. Exactly.
And even being vulnerable too, to say, if you develop a competing attachment and you realize that it's happened, you can say to your partner in a safe space, I've developed some kind of an attachment. I'm displacing myself. I say that's moving your person to someone else. It could even be to your mom, or it doesn't matter, but the idea is you're moving your
or to your podcast co-host.
Right. Right. Mm-hmm. You know, mm-hmm. and that person becomes your person, but then we become, I don't know. I feel like people might become too ashamed or guilty to say it. And then that puts even a further division instead of just saying, I've developed some kind of competing attachment. I don't want to keep going down this road, and I want to talk with you, and I don't even know how to deal with it, but I want to be transparent.
1,000%. And, you know, and it's hard. It's hard. I think if you've gotten to that place to give yourself permission to get honest with self and then to share it with, you know, our partner, it's hard. Again, like shame can be a real blocker, right? But, you know, I would say our shame, it grows in secrecy. Mm-hmm. Right. The more that I keep it to myself, right, the more that the shame grows. Right. And so it has to just be, you know, and it requires courage. Right. But the way the body is interpreting it as danger, I always try to just encourage people to recognize that perhaps it's not danger as much as it feels like danger in like the input, that it's not danger. It's discomfort. It's discomfort. Mm-hmm. And we can tolerate that discomfort. We run from danger or we fight danger. But it is a healthy practice for us to tolerate discomfort. So like building that distinction between danger and discomfort. Yeah.
I'm having that discussion now with somebody that it's like, just to have these, like, you don't have to, having conversation or having conflict is not a bad thing, right? Mm-hmm. That you don't have to be quiet or not say the things that I'm doing that are annoying or upsetting because you don't want to create conflict. Because if you don't talk about it, it's going to be much worse down the road. And I can handle it, right? Years ago, I would have been more reactionary, but now I'm not. And I really feel like the talking is necessary and to get all of that stuff out. I mean,
that's right. It's critical. You know, when I was sharing about the pursuer and the withdrawer, it's often the pursuer that's like, we got to talk about this right now. We got to talk about all the things. And I, you know, it's the fight for the relationship. The withdrawer is like, I got to get out of here to fight for the relationship. Right. So they're both like, the intention is the same, to preserve the connection, but they're engaging it in almost like opposite ways.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Mm-hmm. And so it's like, how do you engage this, this kind of dialogue, right? Or conflict even, in a way that can still be regulated, in a way that communicates to you the relationship can still be preserved.
Right. Right. Wow. This is an amazing conversation. I mean, we could talk to you all day. And our listeners could probably listen to you all day. I mean,
this has been
absolutely fascinating. Just to kind of, you know, as we're wrapping up, wanted to kind of put it out there to you. First of all, a huge thank you for your insight, your time, your experience, and sharing that with us and our listeners. And, you know, if our listeners wanted to learn more about you, they maybe wanted to get some resources, you know, where can they find you? What's on the horizon for you? What do you, you know, kind of what's in your wheelhouse these days?
Sure. Well, I continue to be in private practice. And you can just learn about, you know, my work with clients through my website. It's the best place. And that's juliehalltherapy.com. So, I would say, and it has some great resources for people as far as books. I'm not an author myself, but I love authors and I love reading. When I can, or podcasts. And so, that would be the best place to learn more about my work.
And you said you're in Connecticut and you're licensed in Connecticut and was it
New York?
New York, New York.
Yeah.
Okay, great.
Yeah. 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 So,
and you do Zoom stuff as well.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Great. Yep. I'm in person and I'm in Zoom, and I found both of them to be great, effective mediums. So, yeah.
Excellent. Well, Julie, thank you so much for being on again. We really, really appreciate it. And what a really great contribution to this season. So for all of our listeners out there, until our next episode, go out there and rock those relationships. If you liked what you heard, check out our show notes for resources from today's episode. Make sure to follow us on Facebook and Instagram under Rock That Relationship, and go to our website at rockthatrelationship.com for updated episodes and more great information.
Thanks for listening. Now go rock those relationships.